Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today. Hi, fam.
Phew.
It's the end of February already, and I stand by my statement that while January was approximately 800 days long, February was a blink. But I'm excited for today because of two things. First, it's one of my son's birthdays, so we get to celebrate him. And then number two, we are talking about the neuroscience of OCD with the fabulous Uma Chatterjee. And that's worth celebrating too, because as we'll discuss a bit later, science and research brings a magical type quality to mental health treatment, medical health treatment, you name it. And why? Because when you or your loved ones live with something as debilitating as OCD, we want to know that what we are doing, or not doing as it turns out, really matters. And freedom and hope is expanded the more we learn. So join me for part one of a two-part series on OCD and the brain, starting now.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Okay, family. Okay, alrighty. What a pleasure it is to be with you today. Like I mentioned, February has really flown by, but you know what, fam? That doesn't mean it's been easy. Short month, quick month, still a hard month for a lot of people, I know. And we're all coming to this episode from different places. Maybe things for you right now are great, or maybe they've totally sucked, or maybe you're feeling hopeless. Maybe you're part of our replay fam and you're like, sister, it's not even close to February, but yes, I am in the thick of it and still on your own struggle bus. Whatever the case may be, you're welcome here, your family, it's okay. It's okay to not be okay. That sucks, doesn't feel good, but you're with family. And I get it. It's been a rough month, rough year for me too, and I'm just keeping it real because this is the fam and that's how we do it. We keep it real. But also, today is a joy and a celebration. I tell you, my birthday boy woke up with such joy about seeing some streamers and embracing his day ahead. And I love the innocence and genuine happiness, which feels harder to embrace as we get older. I don't know about you. Sometimes we're like birthday grumps. But it was a sweet reminder to see him really just enjoy and embrace the day ahead. And I look forward to more celebration and merriment after he gets out of school. Also, I'm ecstatic because today kicks off part one of two chats with the fabulous doctoral student, world advocate, and also just super interesting, funny, and fabulous lived experience warrior, Uma Chatterjee. Seriously, I had such a great time chatting with her, and her story is so inspiring and relatable and hope-bringing. So I know you're going to love it too. And then, you know, it's Friday. New episodes always roll out on Friday, but as if I needed another reason to love Fridays because I get to hang out with you, there's also a new episode of Severance dropping. And I don't know, are any of you watching the show? Because since we're talking about the brain, it's a brain-driven, neurological, existential psychodrama, maybe. It also involves some like culty elements. I mean, it's not necessarily a category that you can find on Netflix, but if there were such a category, I'd be all for it. It's streaming on Apple Plus, though, and I definitely recommend it if you like, you know, brain-driven, neurological, existential psychodramas with a cult-adjacent storyline. Yeah, check it out. But anywho, fam, let me tell you more about our brilliant guest, Uma Chatterjee, because there's so many interesting topics that we're going to cover today and next week. So Uma is an award-winning neuroscientist, science communicator, and mental health advocate. Her neurobiology research and advocacy are all informed by her own lived experience of lifelong OCD and comorbid psychiatric conditions. She currently serves as president of OCD Wisconsin in all of her off time, I'm sure, and as an advocate for the International OCD Foundation. If you hang around the interwebs or have recently attended conferences to learn more about OCD, you've likely seen or heard of Uma and her fantastic work. And seriously, fam, we're so lucky to have her incredible heart, passion, and intellect advocating for better and more targeted research for OCD. So we're going to dive in, but one final housekeeping note I want to mention is a trigger warning for today's episode, as we will discuss severe symptoms and suicidality during this episode. So be aware of that. Listen with your own discretion. But if you can, join us, because there's so much hope and learning ahead, and I can't wait for you to hear more. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast. I am thrilled today because I have Uma Chatterjee. She is currently a doctoral student at University of Wisconsin-Madison. I am thrilled to have her here because you may be familiar in terms of learning about some of the neuroscience around OCD because of all of the amazing advocacy work that Uma has been doing. And Uma's just getting started, y'all. So it's very exciting. But what she's been able to do in such a small amount of time, I am thrilled. And so, Uma, can I call you a friend?
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, you are a friend, and I can't wait to have so many more conversations after this.
Yes, exactly. So Uma, first things first, you have such a powerful story, and I'm going to link over on the blog family if you want to check out, because Uma's done such great, amazing advocacy work. You can hear more about her story, but we're going to go into a bit of it today, too, in how she got into researching and studying OCD. And so Uma, I think it's interesting because I've had a lot of different practitioners, some researchers on the show, and sometimes people are like, it's been a lifelong endeavor. And other times people are like, oh, it found me. I didn't find it. So I'd love to hear your story on how you got involved with studying OCD.
I appreciate us starting the conversation like this so much because especially when I get more into, you know, scientific hat and talking about research and all the things, I just want everyone to know and understand that this is coming from someone who gets it. And the whole reason that I'm here and the whole reason I do anything I do is because I've lived with OCD my whole life. At least that's what my clinicians have determined. That's how I feel about it. Like, I don't have a memory in my mind where I did not have severe to extreme OCD starting from the time I was so little. And I just really didn't, I had no access to treatment, to resources, to understanding what on earth was going on with me. That was compounded by being in a immigrant household with just there was no access to understanding the concept of mental illness or mental health at all. And there's so much more that goes into that story, but I know that's relevant and important, especially to this podcast and talking about family systems, because that really shapes a person. And yeah, as much as we can't at this point at least control like having or the onset of OCD, like there are so many things that can help a person navigate that. And it's really, really unfortunate that I didn't have that. And so I was just drowning in severe, extreme OCD with taboo themes, with harm themes, with honestly every theme under the sun. It evolved so much and continues to evolve as I continue to live my life. And long story short, I went like 25 years without proper treatment. I had been diagnosed with multiple things by the time I was in my teenage ages. I think it's really, unfortunately, relatable for people to be diagnosed with depression, anxiety, panic disorder, chronic suicidality, all of which I do have. I was then diagnosed with PTSD, also, which I do have. But there was such an underlying missed component of something that was running my whole life. And I, at my worst, I couldn't leave my house. I was waiting to die. I did attempt on my life multiple times, unfortunately. And fortunately, I'm here today to tell the tale. And I got through that. And I also just underwent so much incorrect treatment, both in psychotherapy and, you know, talking to therapists, but then also with medication. And I was just a complete hot mess. I was such a hot mess. And finally, eventually, because of the internet, because of advocacy, because of learning about what OCD actually is, not the way even I used it growing up as like a annoying descriptor for my mom telling me to clean my room all the time, saying like, stop being so OCD. Like I had no idea what it actually is. And the fact that that framed just the whole way I lived my life and the fact that I was constantly afraid of being a horrible person, or I had so much doubt and uncertainty about my reality and every facet of it. And then just doing so many behaviors, many of them mental, that I just thought that was life. And so that paradigm shifting experience of labeling my distress and my just horrific life as OCD, but then starting to do evidence-based targeted treatment with providers who actually understood what the hell they were talking about. Sorry if I can't cuss on here.
No. Cursy words allowed. Here's my stance on it, Uma. OCD's real bossy on what can or can't be said, what would be just right. And I'm like, you know, to hell with that. So don't worry about it. There's like a disclaimer permanently in my intro that there can be adult words, there can be adult themes. Because that's
okay,
life.
Thank you.
That's OCD. Oh, it's fine. But it's also just life. Sometimes we use the cursy words. I don't care.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay, because like my potty mouth. I don't know how I could filter myself.
We're family.
Thank you.
We keep it real. We shoot the shit. It's totally fine. It's totally fine.
But yeah, I was so debilitated by this horrible disorder. I had dropped out of college with a 1.83 GPA. I was basically housebound. I couldn't do anything. I was so lost. I was so confused. And eventually with going through treatment, although it's been a process and I'm still in treatment today, that's a huge part of my story in terms of recovery and normalizing that it might take longer for certain people and that's okay. Like even with that, I live a completely different life than I never thought was possible. Like I was able to go back to school, and especially in the context of this conversation, I was able to earn multiple degrees, my bachelor's and master's and in neuroscience. I am now getting my PhD in neuroscience. But the reason that I do any of that, it's not just because I'm interested in perpetually being
a student.
underpaid. student underpaid. It's because through my recovery, I was just completely mind blown by the fact that my brain had done this to me for so long, and that there were ways for me to like fight with parts of my brain essentially and to take my life back. And I could not stop thinking about what was going on in my brain. And I started off in psychology because I didn't understand neuroscience, largely because in part I was so dysfunctional and unable to engage with school that I just like didn't comprehend that I was capable of understanding things in biological terms, or that was even an option for me. But I just knew like I wanted to understand mental illness, mental health, and how to treat it broadly. From there, I realized I was really interested in understanding what this thing in our head is doing to us and how that is creating this disorder that could take over someone's life like mine and so many people I know. And that's why I study the neurobiology of OCD. And there's so much more to say of how hard that is because of how people don't take OCD seriously as a condition to study or to fund studies for. But that's why I do what I do.
That's amazing. And family, I know you can hear what a warrior we have with Uma and her dedication to not giving up, which probably didn't feel like it for so much of the time. It was probably like, I am drowning slowly and suffering so much. But I love this story because, first of all, it's so relatable. I think so many people listening, their loved ones, or maybe themselves, or if you happen to be a practitioner, somebody you're treating, we have seen the pain and the utter misery that OCD can cause. And so many times we go, oh my gosh, am I ever going to even be able to function through a day, let alone be able to grow my world? And Uma's going, my world got so incredibly small, and here she is taking it back. She's taking back her life. And I think that is such an inspiring way to start this conversation, because I know as somebody, fam, OCD, how we could go, oh, but you don't know, I'm like the worst case here. This is like, it doesn't get worse. And it's like, actually, there's still hope. And so if anything, I love that we get to start this conversation that's so important in understanding neuroscience, understanding how our brains are functioning, with that hope, because you are living proof, Uma. And I just really thank you for sharing that aspect of your story and continuing to let it fuel all this amazing work you're doing. So that is a big thanks. And I just want to start off and say thank you for that.
Thank you for saying that. And thank you for creating a space where I'm welcome to show up as my full self, because as we'll probably get into, my academic journey and trying to do this work, it's surprisingly the opposite, even in most academic institutions and spaces where even when you're studying mental illness and that's your job, like if you dare say that you have it or identify with it at all, you're almost completely shut out from the conversation, not taken seriously and not seen as worthy of being here because God forbid you are not perfect. So thank you for letting me be my full self in this conversation.
Absolutely. I am loving this conversation with all of you, and I appreciate your willingness and your bravery because it's scary to be vulnerable. It's so funny. For anyone listening that has lived experience, you're like, life is scary. Having OCD is scary. But also it takes a lot of bravery and strength and courage to share your story, particularly in a field where that stigma impacts your opportunities. You know, here I feel like in the OCD community, and you would know better or could speak better on this, but I feel like it's embraced and it's really valued when our researchers, when our clinicians have lived experience. And it's not to say if you don't that you're not of value, you are. We need all of it. But I would imagine in the greater neuroscience space that, yes, anything that could maybe present a bias or a variable that could confound some kind of perfect petri dish experiment could be difficult. And so there are some risks in speaking out. And I just love that you are boldly leading in that. And you're like, you know what? I don't give a damn. Or for whatever damns they do give, I'm still going to do it because it's important for people to know they're not alone. And that's powerful. All right, fam. If you're getting value out of our conversation, but you haven't hit subscribe or followed OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts and YouTube, please take a moment, no time like the present, to hit that button. It's free, it's easy, and it ensures that not only will you never miss an episode, but that more folks can find the OCD Family community. Because fam, we know we're better together. Now, back to today's chat. So one of the things I've talked about, and I think an analogy, so bear with me here on my analogy brain, but one of the things I talk about here with the family and for anybody that's new joining is, you know, our brains are really, really powerful. They're fascinating. And if we think about the advancements that we've been able to create over time, one example I use quite a bit is going outside and, you know, there's this like white dot in the sky and the white dot kind of changes forms. And sometimes the white dot's not even there. It's like, where did that white dot go? And that somebody had to at one point go out and be like, that moon out there, I'm going to, you know what? I'm going to build something. I'm going to create something. We're going to go to that moon. We're going to walk on that moon. We're going to have a space station where people from around this earth can live. It's crazy, right? It's crazy sounding. And yet it took that kind of innovation. And that's the power of our brains. When we look around and see technologies, when we see a really cool CGI or a really intense show, I'm really into Severance right now. I don't know if you watch that show at all, but I'm like, how do they come up with these storylines? Oh my gosh, it's so creative. That's the power of our brain. So if we apply the power of our brain, not only to the creative possibilities, but to the intrusive, unwanted realm, if we think about how obsessional content can grow and flourish, our brain's the same brain that was capable of figuring out that we can travel to that white dot in the sky can create some pretty scary possibilities. And so understanding the brain is a really important thing. And I think a lot of people understand, okay, OCD is my braining. I say that quite a bit, my braining. But what does that mean? When we say OCD is happening in the brain, and would love to take people on a journey of understanding why the neuroscience is so important in terms of understanding so that we can work with our brain moving forward and try to embrace life to the degree that we can.
I want to say that my answer is probably going to be construed as very biased because at this point in time, my vocation and expertise is in neurobiology and neuroscience. But with that, the reason that I have chosen this as part of what I do with my life and a large part of it is because I came to this feeling and realization that I'm about to share with you before that. So yeah, it's biased. And also like I've sort of honed in from where I started anyway, which is that when you say like, what is the importance of understanding our brain? I mean, my short answer is it's everything. It's literally everything. Like there is such an interesting dialogue out there that I came into as someone, again, this is why it's so important to know I lived experience, that came into this as someone just like suffering and then going through recovery and treatment and being like, what the actual like hell is going on with all of this, right?
Right.
And it's so interesting that people see, broadly speaking, psychology and neuroscience as two different things, or like, you know, our mind versus our brain, like this whole dualism idea. It's so interesting people see it that way when like quite literally our brain, like this organ in our head, is what governs and runs our entire existence, the entire way we exist in the world, perceive the world, interact with the world. Every thought and feeling we have is generated by this organ. And so like, of course, it's the most important thing, in my very biased opinion, to understand, because it's the crux of it all. And now there are so many different ways of interacting. If we take the condition OCD, there's so many ways of treating and interacting with the pathology that we experience as someone with OCD, whether, you know, people then parse it out into psychology or therapy versus medication versus so many other things, but they're all interacting with the same brain system. And just because, if we take, you know, psychotherapy and that type of treatment, just because it's verbal, just because it's interacting with a person, and just because we're not like sticking an electrode in someone's head or taking a drug, that doesn't mean it's any less neurobiologically effective or driven than like more classically perceived neurobiological elements. So I think like the brain is the most important thing to understand, and everything that all the disciplines that contribute to the brain. We can talk about genetics and so many other things, but like it's what governs, at least in my view and the view of most people I know, it governs our entire existence and how then we experience things like OCD.
Yeah, it's such a great point. And, you know, even when we have sometimes conversations, if we don't necessarily consider ourselves brainiacs or super knowledgeable on it, how many people have ever had a conversation about, well, do you think this is nature versus nurture? It's all brain, though, right? Nature and nurture are impacted and processed through the brain. And so when it comes to OCD, and that conversation will come up sometimes in terms of people going, well, is OCD hereditary, a response of nature or nurture? Is it impacted by the environment? Because we learn things here in the family community, particularly, that sometimes we can respond in such a way that is just as effective as the person responding to their OCD. And so we do see the power and the role that environment plays. And so we'd love to have you talk a little bit more about, and I know that there's still a lot that is being learned and investigated, but would love to have your overview of how OCD is operating in the brain.
Yeah, I always like to start with just that question of nature versus nurture and genetics versus environment, and so many of those almost paradoxes that are thrown out. And I love that you said that at the end of the day, they're all impacting the brain regardless. So it's like, that's the reconciliation factor of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people often wonder, I think mostly because people are trying to justify in their minds, especially with stigma around mental illness, that like, is this something that like I'm just choosing for myself, or is this something that happened to me? And like, that is a really sad experience that people have to ask these questions that I find fascinating irrespective of that question. But nonetheless, just to set the stage, genes are, and genetics are extremely, extremely complicated. But like, the best way I understand it is like, genes, first of all, there's almost, in the case of psychiatric illnesses, like not one gene or gene candidate, or even a few for that matter, that are like the gene for this disorder. You know, there are exceptions to that, and sometimes that's found in other disorders. But for the most part, we're at this point where we have accepted that most conditions are not implicated by one or a few genes as the gene. It's also not just if it's a few genes that you're probably going to have it, or gene variants rather. It's more that they're all building up a risk and vulnerability to be able to cross over to the threshold of having the pathological disorder, versus just like predisposing traits or predisposing elements to your brain that might sort of experience parts of a disorder before it becoming full blown. So genes dictate so many parts of our life. And I think it's important to put that in perspective of neurobiology, that like the reason genes matter is because genes dictate like literally how our brains are formed and how those structures are formed and how cells are formed, how many cells are made, the different properties of the cell and how they communicate, how active they are, et cetera, et cetera. And they all build up together to create the unique person that you are, right?
Uma, so sorry. Can I ask a clarifying question too? Because sometimes you can have the gene for something, but it doesn't necessarily mean the same outcome, or there's a lot of variability in outcomes, or even if it's activated versus dormant. I'm just thinking, because I have like celiac, and I could eat gluten most of my life until I couldn't. And I was a gene carrier for celiac, but that wasn't in an autoimmune sense. It wasn't activated. So not to make it about celiac, but are there situations then where certain genes are going to be informing your modus operandi, and other times genes can be activated or turned on more or less in later stages? And then and then the golden question is how, why, when? Everybody wants to know.
Exactly. So that, yeah, that's definitely the next part of like the how people distill it down to the environment. Essentially, like, what are the factors that play into a set of risk genes, or in the case of you, like a more singular or, you know, a few genes? I was just more so making the point that, like, for very complex brain disorders, we've come to the conclusion it's not like a few, or it's not like you get tested for a gene variant and you're probably going to have it or not. It's just, we don't even have that information yet. We'll get into that later. The point is, it's like hundreds and hundreds, probably, I've heard anywhere from like 400 to 500 gene variants are probably going to be what we find is the cluster for potentially someone developing OCD. And there's always exceptions to that rule as well. So with that being said, then there are so many factors that play into how that plays out in a person, because that's still only in the context of OCD, probably accounts for just 40% of the hereditary nature of OCD. So there's so much more to look at. But at the end of the day, like, there's people that study all of those factors of what plays into it crossing over to the threshold of being diagnosable OCD. Why do some people develop it with that risk? Why do some people not? Why do some people without as much of a risk still develop it anyway? Why do people just develop it at certain ages? Why are there different clusters? Those are endless questions, right? But it, sort of bringing it back to the brain, at the end of the day, those are all questions that can inform the brain, but we have to understand like what the brain is doing to begin with in response to all those factors. Right. And it's easier in some ways to characterize it from the perspective of genetic studies, because at least we can more causally look at the different like reverse translational effects of specific genes and what they do to cells, what they do to the way the brain grows, how that contributes to ultimately what we look at as OCD or any other condition. But yeah, it's a big complicated soup and mess.
Yeah. One of the resources I learned about, and I've learned about it from you actually sharing in one of our provider groups, was about OCD in the brain. And they kind of use this analogy in even the intro video, which again, I'm going to link over on this episode's blog. So if you jump over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com, you can check it out, because it's a short video, but I think it explains quite a lot. But we'll also talk about it here. And it's that idea of like almost like a complex traffic map, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of different moving parts, and there might be a lot of different moving roles. There might be trucks that are delivering things, cars that are traveling, pedestrians that are walking, bicyclists that are, you know, exercising or delivering something. And you think about, you know, when it works well, even if there's traffic, it has to respond to these different signals and responses. And if something were to get even just slightly off, what would the ramifications be in this really complex network of a lot of different moving parts? And so the brain is coordinating. It's so much even more complex than that. But I think it's a good analogy for going, okay, so it's not even all these parts, but it's the infrastructure of the highways and the through streets and the traffic signals and the yields and all the different signs or the lack thereof that can then create some complications in how we're processing information. And so I found that to be a really helpful example of just understanding the multifaceted network that's happening in terms of the information that our brain is trying to process. And, you know, you add to it then this idea of neurotransmitters. A lot of people have heard that word, or they know it's associated, maybe if they've talked ever to their doctor about medication. You and I were talking because she happens to have an adorable serotonin shelf in her bag, in her office, that I was like, oh, look at this like sculptural art that could also like is holding a pink elephant, which I'm here for the irony. I love it. But Would love to have people understand kind of the role of the neurotransmitters too, and why that's impactful and why we're paying attention to it when it comes to mental health or OCD.
I love that you loved OCD in the Brain. I think everyone should check that resource out. It's made for exactly this, to give people a basic understanding of how we're even studying the brain and what we do think we know right now. And I will say up front, like when I say I think we know, it's because in research world, we don't say things with certainty ever, which is ironic given having OCD. But it's very much like, you know, this is the best guess we have. I mean, there are some facts, but really they're not. So to just preframing the way I speak with that, because I'm very careful in the way. But taking that analogy, and before we get into specifically neurotransmitters, like to add more complexity to that analogy of the traffic jam and everything, then you get more even into like, there's all the ways that, you know, the networks and the jamming and all the factors that go into how information flows, or I guess in this case, how, you know, things are transported, where they stop, where they start, regulating all that, right? But then you even get into like the more nitty gritty variability and, you know, things like cell diversity. But in this analogy, it's like all the different types of vehicles that exist and all the different sizes of the vehicles that exist and the number of wheels they have, like different trucks versus cars and versus bikes. And like, I'd say that because like there is just it feels like to me an endless level of how much you narrow down the level of inquiry and upon which you're looking at, whether are you talking about like just like molecules and how molecules interact with cells and different cell types. There's so many different cell types, even within, you know, certain brain regions and how they all interact. And then, you know, different types of receptors on those cells and what governs, what pulls them in, what makes them more active, like what types of receptors are expressed. And then that all equates to how these different cells interact to create networks and how then ultimately regions are communicating with each other. And then this somehow in this long, long, long twisted way constructs this reality we are in right now. So it's just this, I mean, you can even get down to like the type of paint on each car, right? Like, and I say that not even as a joke, like really, truly, that's the level of, there's so much information that we are working to uncover. Like, that's why we need so many people in our fields doing exactly this type of work. But coming back to neurotransmitters, broadly speaking, they are the chemical agents that are used for cells to communicate with each other. And what's so fun and complicated at the same time about neurotransmitters is that when we take things like medication, generally speaking, they're working at the level of being able to, let's take SSRIs, right? I'm sure most people can get more information on this. I don't have to get too much into it, but they're allowing basically, for example, with serotonin, like for it to not be taken back into the cell as easily so that it facilitates more communication and more release. Ultimately, it's not giving someone serotonin. It's like helping that communication, right? But the fun and also complicated thing about it is that, you know, this like serotonin is not just like, okay, we're targeting like this one part of the brain and we're manipulating this very, very complex network in this one part and we're fixing this one traffic jam so it fixes everything else. Like really, we're attacking like all the, for I guess in this analogy, maybe let's say we're taking all the traffic lights and we're trying to fix all of them. And like with this, like the electricity versus like going into this one part where there's this one issue because only one of them's not working and we're fixing it there. So we're broadly like administering it, which has a whole host of side effects. And also part of neurotransmitters, it's so interesting, especially in the treatment of most psychiatric disorders, which is sort of scary to hear, but it's also just the reality, is that we're oftentimes utilizing mechanisms that we found by luck to help buffer symptoms, but we're not actually always like targeting the cause or, you know, supposed cause or like the actual thing that's driving the disorder in the first place. So there's so many, even just with serotonin, like different going theories of like how and why SSRIs or anything related to serotonin can work in psychiatric disorders, especially OCD. And it can be anything from just like compensatory mechanisms of being able to induce more synaptic plasticity, that basically just like being able to rewire networks better, essentially, rather than like it's a serotonin deficiency. And thus we are just helping people with that exact deficiency and giving them what they need. So there's a lot I can say there. The point is like, it's really interesting, but I think what people don't talk about a lot is how we're just broadly impacting a system by giving someone a medication at this point in the way we have the technology. And hopefully we can get more narrow as time goes on.
It's interesting because my husband's a software engineer, and so I don't pretend to get all of it. But what I will say is it reminds me a lot of, if we look at like a functional behavioral analysis of how maybe medications are working. It's like going in and fixing a general bug that's going to impact all those, like you said, traffic lights across the system, which is great if it fixes this one, but it might cause breaks and leaks all over, you know, in other spaces. And so being able to narrow down, and that's what a lot when it comes to different diseases or different mental health disorders, a lot of what we're looking at in some of those clinical trials where we're trying to go, okay, but can we zone in on this specific thing because that seems to be related to this specific disease or this specific disorder? And it is a very, very complex network. And so understanding, it does seem there is a role or at least a positive effect that I don't even know if positive is the right word. You correct me because I'm not I'm certainly a novice when it comes to some of this stuff, but a positive effect that serotonin has on OCD, like we've learned from my understanding, at least, and hearing from some of the psychiatrists in the OCD field, that serotonin generally does more for the brain and the brain will respond better to serotonin medications like SSRIs, which are frontline for OCD, but not always. But this is my understanding of the research. And so what are we finding in relationship to, yes, there needs to be more work done, but serotonin versus some of the other things. And then I would also love to talk about some of the emerging research, because I know that you do research in psychedelics as well, that fits well into this kind of conversation. So would love to hear your thoughts on it.
In what you said, that like the net effect of how much serotonin oriented medications are helping people, that is valid and true. And I'm so grateful that like for this condition and other conditions that we have, by sheer magic, honestly, like it was so random in the way that it was found, like it's kind of scary of the story. With it being found that way, like it's helping people, and a big and, the fact that one, it's not like directly attacking what the term of like pathophysiology, meaning just like what is causing or driving said disorder in the brain. Like the fact that that's not what's being attacked with like the vast majority of treatments we're using. And also the glaringly big group of people that it's, while the majority of people are helped, there's still so many people who are not helped by that medication, is in many ways reflective one of biodiversity. Like not everything helps everyone, even if it is the correct proper treatment targeting the actual crux of the disorder or disease or whatever.
Right.
But also because I just said that we're not, like in many ways, I'm not, it's a very complicated answer, but largely speaking, we're not, like that also speaks to what can we do to help everybody, right? So that kind of takes me to, this isn't exactly what you asked, but I think this is like where you were sort of leading to, of like, what is driving OCD in the brain? What do we know? And there's so much we don't know. And I will constantly frame that because like what I am sharing is based on decades and decades of research and replication, starting with humans and using imaging studies. I just want to go over a primer of this because people get confused by techniques and how we do research and what neuroscience even means. But like, I think it's intuitive to people that you would want to look in a person's brain to see what OCD looks like, because that's, you know, like where OCD exists. We're not necessarily like looking at OCD in horses all the time, right? Yeah. Although that's debatable. But the point is, we care about humans, we're humans right now. So,
right.
But the thing is, with the technology we have and the ability to look at a person's brain, we can't really get that invasive with people, like without crossing ethical boundaries. I don't think anyone wants to volunteer themselves for it. I certainly don't. So the closest thing we can do are a variety of different imaging types of studies, which have been so helpful, and they're technological feats, and they have a lot of limitations. So we start with imaging people in a whole variety of ways, looking at, on a very high level, like how active certain regions are when in a whole variety of tasks, and when people are experiencing like the intensity of an obsession or doing a compulsion versus just, you know, resting state, like, or when they're not doing anything, just what their brain looks like naturally as compared to people who don't have OCD or whatever condition. There's like the sample and then the controls, right? And we can also look at, with some advanced technology, things like, you know, receptor density and things like that, just from image pictures. And we're using blood flow and oxygenation and a whole bunch of things. But the bigger issue from that, people take the idea of brain scans and think that, one, those can diagnose disorders or identify OCD in a person, for example. And that is absolutely 1000% untrue. I'd like to debunk that up front. If anyone is telling you that or telling you that's the case, run. Nobody with any credentials or any level of ethics would ever say that, because it's simply untrue. Like when you see representative pictures, even going across the internet in terms of trying to with good intention, say that, oh, no, this is a brain disorder. Look at this brain image. Like, typically, that's a collated representative image of potentially across samples where different common threads are, something being active in that specific context, like if they're doing a certain task or a certain thing. But you cannot put someone in a scanner and determine if they have a disorder. If it were that easy diagnosis, we would be in a different world right now. And so then I ask, like, did anybody with a license ever give you a brain scan and tell you have disorder? No. So that's just not the case. And I just want to debunk that up front because I get the question every day.
Would that be with the fMRI studies and whatnot, where they kind of look back and in hindsight? What I will say is, from what I do know of the research world, is data is data. And then you can spin data to try and answer or force an answer on certain questions. So if you look at 200 patients, let's say, that you know had OCD, and you find some commonalities across those brain scans, it's very tempting here in the general population to go, well, then that's why. Because these things must be markers. And could they be markers? Could they not be markers? Well, hindsight's 20/20, and we can kind of create and construct the story we want to create and construct. But it is why you're not getting diagnosed on the flip side, because maybe of the general population, most people have those markers. That doesn't necessarily mean OCD. And if we were to zoom out and look at it across the entire population, we'd realize that is a nothing. Right? Like, these are just shared traits of our humanity, perhaps, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Oh, 1,000%. And that's one large example of, like, why statistics matter so much, why training in statistics and why actual peer review of journals, but even beyond peer review of journals, like, I said this before on podcasts, like, there are so many journals in the world that are predatory in terms of publishing papers, which is what you're referring to in some ways, that, like, you could just publish a paper and, like, I could call it peer reviewed because, like, my friend peer reviewed it and they're a peer because they're also a PhD student. And then it's just out there. And so the rigor and reproducibility and, like, breaking down things like statistics, and, like, you can make statistics even, like, reflect something being significant when it's not, based on the way you massage the data. Like, it's just, there's so much subjectivity in it, to your point. So that's why it might look appealing to take some sort of clear-cut answer from a paper, which, by the way, not one paper will ever tell you anything, like, in the field. Right. Like, you have to have that founded so many different ways to even start to come to a conclusion about something and then potentially translate it to treatment or practice. But whatever the case is, like, it's just exactly what you said. Like, you can see something as a signal, especially, like, if you're looking for something, you're going to find it. And so that's just constant training on bias and blinding and so many things that we have to do. Hence why, like, people take, it takes so long to be able to do this work and become an expert and to be trained in a way of thinking and limiting those biases as much as you can with that. Because it is tempting to do exactly what you said. People are making so much money by deciding that they have the novel way of identifying a biomarker or this, that, or the other thing. So just be aware of all of that. And if trusted organizations that, like, represents a disorder or, like, you know, national agencies and stuff are not saying that that's the case, it's probably because it's not the case yet. Like, we would love for that to be the case. But sorry, that is a whole side tangent on misinformation. But I was talking about the human brain imaging study because that's where we start. Like, that's, we have to get data from people. And so by scanning people in a whole variety of ways, with whether it's fMRI, CT scans, PET, so many different things, you can get starting points of, like, where should we look? But from there, we have to get more specific about, like, what is actually happening in that region? How are they actually communicating? What are the mechanisms on cellular levels, on molecular levels? What influences this system and specifically this part of the circuit to interact in this way? And so that's why we have to translate to non-human models. And that's where I live. I live at that translation. And I never in my life imagined I would be working with mice or working with any animals. And I'm still so afraid of them. And that's a constant exposure experience for me. But the reason that I got into understanding beyond humans, like, what do you do after you scan a human and get some information? Like, how do you actually figure out what's going on? You have to do invasive methods. Like, you have to do brain surgery and, you know, different types of animals. Like, most usually we're using species like mice and rats and even non-human primates. And that's a whole other conversation of how people feel about that. But my answer to that is, if you take in a medication, then you're okay with that. That's just, like, the best we have at this time. We also can do things with human-derived stem cells and whatnot, but there's just so many limitations on each model. But essentially, we're trying to use these models to do things like directly manipulate cell types. And, you know, we can do magical things like using blue lights to turn certain cells on and see, like, if we turn these on, do animals, like, you know, scratch themselves to death in a way that seems quote unquote compulsive, because another thing we're doing is we're not trying to anthropomorphize animals, but there are certain behaviors that we can take and we can look at how that overlays onto symptoms in humans. And while it's so complex, we can parse those things out. So to answer the question of potentially what is going on in the brain of OCD, what we do go off of as a going theory is the idea that there's one specific circuit. We call it the cortical striatal thalamic cortical loop. And it's basically exactly that. It's multiple high level regions that communicate with each other that relate to different elements, which I think is cool, of like what we experience with OCD in terms of like an over salience or over importance of certain stimuli that other people are able to shake or they're able to not be so affected by. But people with OCD get like, oh my gosh, what if? Or oh my gosh, this is so loud and intrusive and I can't ignore it. And then what do we do from there? We do behaviors. We do behaviors that are physical or mental. Those are coordinated by our motor systems. And from there, that signals to our brain and body that this is actually important. And because we're acting on said intrusive experience, we're then telling it that we should keep doing that. And so it becomes a cycle. And so that loop is overactive in the brain. That's a very high level way of describing it. And from there, like, there's so many things people are doing like me to figure out exactly like what cell types are doing what and what genes are governing these specific anomalies in the circuit and these regions. And yeah, I could go on forever. This would be like my whole career. But no, essentially, there's so many levels of inquiry with that, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Hey, real talk. If you've made it this far into the pod, chances are you love learning about OCD. So why not take it up a notch? Head over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to browse the OCD Training School's incredible lineup. And when you use my special link, you're not just investing in great education. You're also supporting this podcast at zero extra costs. With courses ranging from self-help to continuing education for clinicians, offering live and on-demand options to fit your needs or your time zone, the opportunities are vast. OCD Training School has your back. And when you use my link, you have the fam's back too. So go check it out at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And now, back to the show. Before I was in the OCD field, I had a different specialty and I was in 0 to 5. And we talked a lot about in that age group between 0 to 5 and really in teenagehood, how we have our greatest periods of brain growth and we have the most neuroplasticity. And when you're talking about you've had OCD as long as you can remember, what's interesting, and I think it's not that it's not there for people, but that it takes so long for people to understand or get properly diagnosed anyway. In terms of pediatric research that we have, between 7 and 12 years old, if you're going to get a diagnosis in childhood, typically those are the age ranges. It's not to say you can't fall outside of that. For adults, it can take 14 to 17 years. I will say for myself, 30. To realize that what I was actually dealing with was OCD. And so for a lot of people, it can range longer. Sometimes people can find out sooner. But you're talking about, and for good reason, we don't run these kind of experiments on humans or little children and teenagers. But what I would say is, since those are times where the brain is a bit, from my understanding, more malleable and has a capacity to learn almost anything. We're born, for example, with the capacity to learn like any language. But then when we don't use or don't reinforce certain learning in the brain, then our brain kind of loses some of that ability or capability. And it doesn't mean we can't go back later and learn another language. But it's not going to be as easy and it's not going to be the path it would have been had you learned it when you were 3. And so in terms of kind of thinking about the brain too, and I don't know because there's so many different facets of it, but I wonder to what degree does neuroplasticity or the lack thereof then also have an impact on how OCD works and operates? Does that make sense?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I think that begs the defining, I guess, of neuroplasticity, because that is something that I'm happy that people are so excited about that term, because I think it's been shared in the mental health community in a way that describes essentially the ability for the brain to change itself. And that is something that there are more rapid times that overlay with oftentimes critical period. Like you said, think back to being a kid and there's certain age ranges where you were able to learn a language faster than you are now. And also, there are other things that people think about less, but like in terms of people that are born with hearing deficiencies or visual deficiencies, you have to intervene within a certain age range or else like you can't even reshape those circuits. And so even though we understand how to treat it, like if you don't treat it in that critical period is what that's called, like it doesn't work. And so those are like extreme versions of that. And I think is a lot of times what people are thinking about in terms of neuroplasticity, but then also just to be super technical, we talk about plasticity often. And when I said earlier plasticity, I'm talking about synaptic plasticity and the ability for a cell to change how active it is and then how it's communicating with other cells and thus like creating a network. And so that they all interplay with each other. But I guess to your larger question and your larger point, I think it's really truly both and in that, yes, I actually have like an anecdote about this. So I'm the president of OCD Wisconsin, and we run a Fearless Family Camp every year. It's for kiddos from ages 10 to 13 that get to come and do intensive OCD treatment and therapeutic camp with their parents. And like I said before, I did not have treatment or family support or anything like that growing up. And so it was such a fascinating experience for me to be with these kids for like 3 to 4 days and watch how rapidly they were able to like do exposures they weren't able to do for years. And like, it was so moving and powerful. And I caught myself being really worried about these kids, like, oh my gosh, like they're making so many gains here, but when they go back, are they just going to like slip back? And oh my gosh, this is so sad. And I was voicing this to the therapist at the camp, and they were like, oh my gosh, no, when you work with kids, it's actually so different than adults. Like they grasp onto it so much faster and they're able to just, once they get it, they get it. And I felt a lot of grief in some ways. I was like, damn, I really, like, I'm so sad that I did not have that opportunity to be able to, in many ways, get better faster so that I don't have to be in treatment 2 to 3 times a week now. And that is just what it is. But all that to say, like, that is, you know, an anecdotal even example of just the ability to intervene earlier on, both from a plasticity standpoint, but also just from a pattern hardening standpoint. It's intuitive to think that someone at the age of 7 is able to change the way they think and then break cycles, as opposed to someone who's 25 or 30 years old that's been doing it for that much longer and has developed their entire existence around a way of thinking and a way of behaving. So there is that element. And big and, it's amazing how much the brain can do just by, I say just not because like therapy is less impactful than medication. It's not. It's actually my point. But people sometimes view it as that. But even just psychotherapy and talking and then like working on behavior, the amount that that shapes our brain, like everything shapes our brain. Like if we go slip outside tomorrow on the ice, like I almost did recently, then my brain's going to reshape and learn that I should probably be more careful on the ice because now I'm in Wisconsin and not in Texas. Like there's things that happen to us all the time. And unfortunately, you see that in negative contexts where people develop PTSD, like they encounter a very severe trauma and then develop PTSD at an age that's older as opposed to like when they were younger. That happened maladaptively too. So our brains are always interfacing and changing. It's that sometimes it's easier before, but also medications and things that, you know, like I said before with SSRIs, like going theories that we're increasing the ability for the brain to change itself to, but like on a very like, compared to what I'm going to talk about later, probably psychedelics, like a more passive level. And then there's things like psychedelics where one of the main, you know, ideas in the field is that essentially we're able to reopen critical periods that we're not able to do like in regular life. Those critical periods I talked about before that like are able to supercharge the ability for the brain to change itself, we're able to do that in a positive way. And then therapy is able to be more effective. So that's a long-winded answer of saying it's so complicated. Yeah. It'd be nice to get everything in childhood, but we certainly have hope as adults.
You know, what I would say, maybe a conversation for another time, but I was just thinking because I have a loved one with Parkinson's too. And so we see in those kind of neurological disorders where serotonin is impacted, a lot of different things in the brain are impacted. But it made me wonder too, even something in terms of opening critical periods, if there's something to even something like psychedelics, where yes, you're combating a disease and you're combating degeneration, but also if you could open up critical periods, that sounds like an exciting prospect for so many different avenues.
It almost sounds like magic, doesn't it?
It does feel like magic. Tell me of this magic.
I mean, that's what science feels like to me. People see it as so boring and scary and to each their own, but like I honestly don't even identify as a scientist. That sounds really weird. I'm just more so in awe of all the things that we're able to do without the Harry Potter version of magic. We're able to just like manipulate cells with blue light, or we're able to like administer this wild like mushroom that grows and somehow people are able to like relearn how to speak again. Like what? What the heck?
Well, and if you think about, too, how the brain assimilates, like if we use the traffic analogy we were using earlier, even if we're not building new roads, the brain has an incredible ability to recalculate the route, you know, in terms of figuring out a way to get places. And that's why things like rehabilitation and where people may have had injury or disease that have caused a loss in functioning, and the brain can reroute strategies to assimilate. You were talking about hearing difficulties and things. My husband was born deaf in one ear, but his brain has assimilated and created lots of, like, almost hyperattunement in some of his other senses for survival, right? You know, so he can't localize sound, but he has a hyperattunement to different visuals and has different behavioral scanning things he will do to make sure he doesn't get hit by a car because he's not going to hear it coming across the street. And so it is interesting. The brain is driven to protect. And I feel like I could talk to you forever, and I know that we are at time, but we're going to be talking for one of two, Uma, one of two episodes. I am so thrilled. There's so much good stuff. It's just the right amount to chew on. And you know what, fam? Again, you can jump over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com, check this episode's blog, because Uma's doing presentations and talks and so much work all the time. So many live streams or different types of podcasts, etc. And it's amazing. So I continue to look forward to hearing what you have to say. And we just appreciate you taking the time to hang out.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you so much for asking such amazing questions and really being willing to go there. And I just appreciate your compassion and care and really wanting to bring this information to the community. I think, like, people are afraid of it sometimes, and there's no perfect way to, I have to know there's no perfect way to share this. And I'm definitely going to, like, fuck shit up. But thank you so much for, like, allowing that. And I love talking to you, and I can't wait to talk more.
Yes, Uma. Intrusive thoughts. Okay, fam. What do you think? Interesting, yeah? And how lucky are we to have Uma's expertise, wisdom, and insight? I mean, it's such an incredible treat. So another special thank you to Uma, as well as an extension of gratitude and a reminder for the fan that Uma will be back for part two of this chat right here next week. Also, I know I mentioned this earlier, but if you're interested in learning more about Uma or any of the resources we were discussing today, jump on over to OCDFamilyPodcast.com and look for this episode's blog for YouTubers. The link is always in the description below, and you can get the lowdown. Alrighty, so that brings us to the Intrusive Thought segment, which is my application segment of the show for any newer fam joining us, where we really try to distill some practical takeaways from today's chat and figure out how we can apply it today. And when it comes to neuroscience, you might be thinking, okay, but how are you going to do that, Nicole? This was fascinating, but what? How? Well, the answer might be much easier than you'd think. Remember earlier when Uma talked about living in Wisconsin, and per the weather, it had been icy out. I mean, here in the Midwest, it can be icy any time between October and May. But when Uma and I recorded, it was an ice skating rink for both of us. And so she talked about learning after a near slip to be extra cautious when walking outside. This simple experience led to a behavioral experiment of practicing more caution and precision in her steps next time she encountered that environment. Her brain adapted quickly, and I bet you she exercised this without much effort, if any effort at all. But whether she had to think about it or not, she practiced incorporating data she had previously collected through her life experience and adjusted accordingly. And what I love about this example is that it shows why we don't have to be scientists that get to use blue lights, though that did sound pretty cool, Uma, I'm not gonna lie, to be scientists in our own life and learn about our own brains. So this week, I want you to practice a little experiment of your own choosing. I'm sure, again, we are all doing this naturally in some way, in some capacity, but I want us to be a bit intentional about it anyway. So for example, I love a double shot of espresso in the morning, but I also love the comfort and the coziness of holding a cup of coffee in my hands and enjoying the warmth from it. It's cozy. So I usually have my double shot with a cup of decaf following because I'm just getting too old to be able to handle any more caffeine than that. But I've always loved my coffee or espresso black. No sweetener, no milk, no cream, no milk alternatives. Blah. And you know what, fam? Judge me if you must, because I know some of you are like, what? That sounds undrinkable. I'd have to have a lump of sugar or some cream or, for some people, butter. I mean, I'm not judging, but I kind of am. That sounds gross to me. But again, to be fair, you might think my preferred way of drinking coffee or even coffee at all sounds disgusting. And usually I would say, that's okay. If I'm wrong, I don't want to be right. But I love things like tiramisu, a coffee-infused dessert. At least I did love tiramisu in my pre-celiac days. So this week, I actually think I'm going to try this behavioral experiment because if I do due diligence to my own hypothesis, something like sweetened coffee may not be the worst thing. But also, maybe it's not something I want or I seek first thing in the morning. It's too sweet. Maybe I don't want to break a fast or have a sugar crash. So I'm going to try sweetened coffee in the afternoon or evening sometime this week. And because of the time of day, it'll have to be decaf for me. But it is worth exploring. Is this something I really detest? Or is this something that I've become accustomed to and been living with this habit for decades, so long that I never actually challenged the assertion that maybe I could like sweet coffee? I don't know. The point isn't to try and switch me to team coffee with sugar. The point is, I have an opportunity to learn something about myself through a behavioral experiment. I can see how my brain responds to it. I can take in that data. I can choose to continue drinking coffee the way I drink it now, or even adapt and vary my drinking in the future. And like Uma said, good science and good research requires multiple trials with consistent findings. We can massage data, as she said, if we really want to. But the point of me practicing this one experiment is because it's worth exploring and seeing how my brain reacts to that. I would think, yuck, I'm not going to like it. Maybe that hypothesis will come true. But maybe it won't, because I do like tiramisu. So that's my little experiment for the week. Why not? I might not change my coffee habits and that'd be fine. Or I might find a new treat I enjoy. And in a world and life when things can be tough, is that such a bad thing? To find another thing we enjoy? Food for thought. Or maybe a drink for thought? So what will you try this week? I'd love to hear about it. And then I'd love to have you come back and join us next week. Because Uma and I are just getting this conversation started. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Uma and me shooting the shit about OCD. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Are your clients struggling with disgust-based contamination OCD? Have you tried upgrading your ERP with the Mastery Approach? Visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses and click on my link because I've got just the training for you. At OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses, you can check out OCD Training School's entire catalog of courses, including Rich Gallagher's course, Treating Contamination OCD. Where else can you build mastery over disgust-based triggers while supporting the fam at no extra cost to you? It's a win-win at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.